This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, Dean Regas, Assistant Director with the Cincinnati Observatory and co-host of Stargazers, will be here. Joining me now in the studio is award-winning TV journalist and author, the host of Science Friday, Ira Flatow. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ira, great to see you this afternoon.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You know, it's obvious when you listen to Science Friday that you just have this passion for this topic, and it sounds like it's a lifelong passion that you probably had since you were a kid.
It's true. I love doing this stuff, you know, and they pay me to do it.
Can't get any better than that, can it?
No.
So what were you like as a kid? Did you have a chemistry set? Were you into model rockets or those kinds of things when you were growing up?
All those things. I was one of these typical geeks. I had a pocket protector. I had slide rules. I wore white socks. I used to build electronic kits in my basement. I had chemistry sets when they had dangerous chemicals still in them, which they don't have anymore.
Before they became politically correct.
That's right. I once almost burned down my mother's bathroom doing a biology experiment that I had done in science club when I was in seventh grade. And I think that was one of the reasons I stayed interested, is that I had a teacher who cultivated your interest in science. She created a science club. And I think that's key to staying interested in science, is having a mentor of somebody. It could be your mother, you know, your father, who takes you through those adolescent years when your interest turns to something else, you know, and keeps you motivated.
So you had a teacher who was an influence. Were there any other influences in your life that?
Well, I used to I hung around with kids who – friends of mine who used to do geeky things. We used to build electronic parts and electronic kits. We used to do model rocketry. Thank goodness we didn't go very far because we were experimenting with gasoline as rocket fuel. That's not – don't try that at home. I warn everybody. So, yeah, we had people – had friends who had like interests.
So I have to know, did you ever make a battery from a potato?
No, but I made it from a lemon. I made it from a lemon with zinc and copper electrodes, and even to this day, you can do that kind of stuff. But
how does that actually work?
Well, it's just two different dissimilar metals. If anybody who has a boat will know that if you put two dissimilar metals together, the electric current happens. So when you're on a boat, you don't put two dissimilar metals because you're sitting in water and it's conductor, and you start corrosion all through the boat. So.
Yeah, well, what can you run with a lemon though? Will it run a watch? Will it run a small radio?
You get enough. You can. Back in the day, we didn't have LEDs. They were just little toys that you read about. Maybe you could get one 1970s, but you can get one that will light up an LED that they don't take. They don't take much current these days.
No, that's impressive. So, how did Science Friday get its start? I mean, what were you thinking when this whole thing was coming about?
Well, I had just concluded, I had a long career at NPR, and I had spent from 1971 to 1986 as a science reporter. I took some time off to do some TV, a TV show called Newton's Apple that was on PBS. Mm-hmm. I'd done that for about 6-7 years, and I wanted to get back into radio. And I was listening around to see what was popular those days. And the radio talk show was being born or reincarnated. And I went to NPR and I said, you know, I'd like to do a science talk show. And they said, how many days a week? I said, I only really want one day. And they said, well, we weren't going to do any more than one day anyhow. But what do we do the other days of the week? And I said, well, maybe I can find other people to fill in those other days of the week. And I started talking to Susan Stamberg and Diane Rehm and some other people who were very well known at NPR. But the big problem was, how do we get public radio stations interested in doing a talk show? Let me think about that. And while I went away to think about that, the Gulf War started in 1990. And NPR created a daily talk show just to cover that Gulf War. And as you know, that war did not last very long, but it whetted the appetite for the stations to have a daily talk show.
So in a strange sort of way, Saddam Hussein had something to do with starting Science Friday.
That's exactly. He was the catalyst for this. And so we went on the year. The Talk of the Nation was first 4 days of the week, and then Talk of the Nation Science Friday was the fifth day. And we will be celebrating, as Science Friday will be celebrating its 25th year starting this fall. We'll be going into our 25th year. So anybody who says, you know, science is not popular does not know really what people like. Science is very, very popular. We have great ratings. People love to talk about science. It's just that they're not quite sure what scientists do. They like the topics. They like the subjects. They like what science produces. And they're just not quite sure what scientists do every day. But they do love science. They do love to talk about it.
So why Science Friday instead of Science Thursday or Science Monday or Science Tuesday?
Well, could be. We were going to be Science Thursday because in the literature, all the science news is released to the public on a Thursday. It gets put out to the journalists on a Monday. We get to see it. But by agreement, we're not allowed to all talk about it till Thursday. And the reason why that started was not for any journalistic reason. It was because of the stock market. People did not want to have, hey, there's a new drug that you know about on a Monday, and they're not going to hear about it till Thursday. You know, it will leak out, and then the price of the stock will go up. But anyhow, so we were going to be on a Thursday, and then when we got the okay to go ahead with the show, they said, look, let's make a block of 4 days, keep it together, and we'll do Friday. And Friday rolls off your tongue a little better. Friday is a little better than
– well, it's a nice way to end the week too.
Yes.
If you enjoy that kind of thing, I love listening to it on a Friday.
It is sort of a weekend-sounding show. We try to make it be a little more lighthearted for a weekend sound.
Are you surprised that the show has been as popular as it's been?
No. I'm not surprised because I have been doing this now, I'm afraid to say this, for since 1971. We're talking 40 years, you know. Science Friday's been on the air since 1991, but I've been doing science since I was the first Earth Day in college. 1970 was my first science experience doing a science story. I'd been covering anti-war demonstrations and riots before that, following Kent State, things like that in college. And I said, here's an opportunity for me to do something I really am interested in, which is science. And Earth Day rolled around, and I did my first science story. But ever since I've been doing that, there has been, you know, continued interest in science. I, like everybody else, thought, I'm the only one interested in this stuff. I'm a geeky guy. Mm-hmm. I'm the only one interested. But I found out, much to my delight, that the more I did, the more science reporting I did, the more people wanted more of it. And even to this day, people really look and love science. Look at, you know, every new show on TV. What is the most popular show on TV? The most popular show on TV is The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
Right? It's about geeky science people. They you know, and then what's the spinoff of that? And then CBS, which is the network for that, came out with the next show was Scorpion. It's about smart, geeky people.
Right.
You know? This is all the new shows that are coming out have a science element to it because the producers are realizing what people know is that we love science and that's where the money is going.
Speaking of the Big Bang Theory, you've actually been on the show a couple of times,
yeah.
Haven't you?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I was on a couple of times. Last time I was on there, it was a segment where Sheldon came on the program. Sheldon had Sheldon Cooper, the character, had thought he had discovered a new kind of particle, and then his roommate disproved the particle, disproved what he had discovered, and they came on because it was a science show to talk about what they were doing. And you know, it was a lot of fun to be called a shock jock at one point by Sheldon, you know, some shock
by his standards.
Yeah, but you know, it just shows you it. As long as you spell my name right but you're talking about science, you get, because that's what my great belief is. My aim, when people say, how do you join, you know, if you're successful? If you're talking about science around the dinner table, like you're talking about what did the Reds do today or so, you know, or sports or stocks, then I think we've been successful. Hey, guess what I heard on the radio today? Guess what I heard on Science Friday today? They were talking about this wacky thing. Then I know we've been doing our job where we have broken that wall through to become a topic of popular discussion.
Do you think a show like The Big Bang Theory helps?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it makes it okay to be a geeky person. You know, if the top stars of the top rated show are all geeky people, then it's okay for we nerds to come out and show that we're geeks. You know, we're staying in our basements or our little laboratories. We can come outside and celebrate the fact that being a geek is good. And now being a geek is very, very hot.
How did you form the relationship with that show in the first place? How did that whole
thing
come about?
They just called me.
Saw the Clear Blue Sky?
They called me. They were sitting around having a story meeting. Producer called me and said, you know, we were sitting around having a story meeting, trying to think of what we could do with Sheldon that week. And then we said, maybe we can put him on a radio show. And we looked around the room and we all at the same time said, Science Friday! And so the first show he was on, He called in to – or I called him in his laboratory. He was working on a project, and they played a trick on him in the first episode where he was in his office, and they filled his office up with helium gas. You know, that whole thing, your voice gets very squeaky.
It makes your voice higher pitched, right.
And that was the joke they played on him in the first –
That was his nemesis, Kripke, who did that to him.
Kripke, right. Yes. And it's funny because they all knew when I got to the set and I'm hanging around during rehearsals and whatever – Kripke, the guy and the actor who plays him, comes over and says, "Hey, Science Friday, I listen to you every week." And then Will, what's his name from Star Trek, who was also
Will Wheaton.
Will Wheaton comes over and says, "Ira, I love Science Friday. Are you going to be around here? My kid is one of your biggest fans. Are you going to be around? Can you get an autograph? That sort of thing." And I'm blown away by this stuff because, you know, I know it's a popular show, but to have all these Hollywood people.
Now, the first time you're on, we just hear your voice.
Right.
Right. It's a phone interview. Second time, we actually see you. You're in a radio studio. Was that your actual radio studio?
I mean, it was amazing. When they said they wanted me to come on the second time, I thought they were saying, okay, we'll do another phone interview. They said, no, we want to rebuild your radio studio exactly how it looks. So you go around and you take pictures of your studio and send it to our art department. And we will recreate it as much as we can here. And sure enough, I watched them building this thing. When I got there, it was almost completed. They were made a few technical mistakes. I said, no, you put the microphone here instead of over here. You wire the cable. They wanted exactly. You wire the cable around the mic stand. It's got to be wired in a circuit, this sort of thing. All right. What else exactly can we make it look like? I said, well, they said, do you have a thermostat? I said, yeah. Where is it? I said, it's right on the wall over there. And we're done. I said, there's only one thing missing, which is the old clock on the wall. You don't have the clock on the wall.
Yep. Got to have that in a radio studio. Absolutely.
And they put it on the wall and they got into sort of an argument amongst themselves about, well, if you put that clock on the wall, time has to go by. We have to move the hands all the time. even though the clock was on the wall, you never get to see it.
Are you impressed with, I think they take a lot of pains to make sure they're accurate.
Yes.
With the science that they're presenting, don't they?
They have a resident science advisor. And while I was sitting there watching the show being taped, there was a guy putting all this calculus on the blackboards that you see in their apartment. He was erasing and putting more calculus on there. And I said, you do that very well. And he said, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just given this little page of stuff that the science advisor gives me. And I'm an artist. I know how to put the stuff on the wall like he shows me. But they do have a resident science advisor who comes in and makes sure what they're doing. Every formula you see in that show is real. And it's accurate, and they take great pride in how well they do that.
We will continue our conversation with Ira Flatow, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and my guest this afternoon is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So when you were a kid, you tinkered with radio kits a
right,
lot.
Right.
Did it make you sad when Radio Shack announced that it was going to file Chapter 11 and start closing stores?
Did it?
Heartbreaking.
I used to live in that store, you know, for parts and pieces and advice. And you would meet other people there who you'd see over and over again who were doing other projects. There were other parts stores. In fact, I did back in the day, back in the late 50s and early 60s, I used to get my parts from before the World Trade Center was there. There was a whole shopping district called Radio Row of surplus World War II parts, and surplus parts from every kind of electronic, whether it was Ma Bell who was installing a new Exchange server and was dumping all its old parts. You could walk down the street. I would go down there once a week, sometimes on a Saturday, go down there shopping by the pound, 5 cents a pound, whatever. You have a big relay, a stepping relay for telephone systems. It was just a magical looking thing. I could buy that for a dime, or I could get all these electronic parts. I could get diodes for a penny. And make I made my first high school electronics project with all those parts. I made a punch card reader. That's how old I am. When back to punch cards, I made a little device that you could use to read with the holes in the punch cards.
Man. Oh, I know what that is. That makes me old too, I guess. Now you got the internet, though. I mean, you can find anything from tubes to fiber optics on the internet.
Right, right. Yeah. And you know, when I still have my old 1947 RCA Victor TV set that I used to watch in the 50s when I was a little kid, watch Howdy Doody and things like that on trying to figure out what to do with it.
So how big was the screen on that?
It was about 7 inches in diameter.
The case around it was probably about 3 or 4 times that
big. You know,
big.
and you can buy a brand new iPad now, and in 70 years, the screen size hasn't changed.
You know, some of the recent topics on Science Friday, you've had polluting planes, I think last week, coked out eels.
Right.
The science of fake grass. The silky wonders of worm spit. Mm. Those definitely got my attention.
I bet.
How do you come up with the topics for the show? And more importantly, who writes the headlines for the website?
Well, we have a whole, besides the radio side, we have a whole website side and an educational side. We have educational producers who make, for example, projects out of the spit, you know, about silk, which is really, you know, worm spit is silk.
Right.
So, and so we will create educational projects out of that. Every week we have a staff meeting, and we go through all these journal articles, the kinds of things that we would like to do. And then we come up with ideas on our own, considering about what's going on. If it's 4th of July or first day of summer, we like to do cooking stories, the science of cooking. We'll know you'll be out barbecuing in the season, so we'll think about science of barbecuing. We had Meathead on a couple of weeks ago, who is a very famous chef, and he talks about the chemistry of barbecuing. I got some hints on that. And so we'll pitch ideas at one another. It takes a long time. It's an hour to 2 hours. We sit around thinking of ideas. And there are so many ideas out there that it's hard to eliminate the stuff. There are so many hundreds of ideas. And we sort of do triage. We have one of two things. We either can see a story that we think everybody will do and we'll do it better in the Science Friday way, or we'll see a really interesting story that we know nobody will do because it's a cute little story, but it's not going to get picked up in the great flow of media. And we'll go with that because it's a nice story that deserves to be heard.
Speaking of interesting stories, what's behind the lifesaver, the sparking lifesaver story?
I did that in 1976, something like 77.
Has it been that long?
Yeah,
wow.
It's been that long. It's about why wintergreen lifesavers spark in the dark, and it has to do with something called triboluminescence. If I'd come on the air and said, "We're today, boys and girls, we're going to talk about triboluminescence," radio dials would have clicked off.
Right, exactly. Crickets chirping and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But I talked about why do wintergreen lifesavers spark when you chew them in the dark, and you could go in the bathroom and try this out, and get your eyes accumulated and see, crunch, shimmer, and it'll spark. And I talked about that, and it was incredibly popular. I mean, got mail for 5 years. More than any other piece on All Things Considered for the next few years.
Sparking lifesavers.
Yeah.
Does anything else spark in the dark?
You can get sugar. You know, lifesavers are made out of sugar. And what happens when you crush the sugar molecule, the sugar crystal, it creates a voltage, and it's really not harmful, but it sparks in the ultraviolet, and you can't see ultraviolet. It's the wintergreen impurity that makes it fluoresce down in that color that you can see. So a lot of things do that.
A lot of things spark. Yeah, science is such a visual thing. How do you translate it into radio?
That's a good question. There are certain things that are very difficult to talk visually. I try to make it that if I could explain it to my mother, then we can do it. You know, if I can boil it down without losing the essence. And sometimes the trick is not to explain it individually, but to explain why people are excited about it. Why do scientists get excited about this thing? What is the core of this thing? And that's how we try to do that.
So you think Science Friday is about popularizing science, or is there something else at work here?
Well, I think it's come you could call it popularizing science because people love science. They want science. You want to make it popular by that means I'm sort of a transducer. You run science through me and out pops some science you can understand, you know? And that's what I view my mission as. I'm no genius, you know, but I have a way. I if there's any talent I have, it is understanding these things and being able to reproduce them in a way that you can understand them. And if that makes it, and by that way, it makes it popular. Not that it's fun and popular, but you get to understand the nugget that's behind what we're talking about, and you get to see why people think it's a great idea.
Now, you've talked about driverless cars, and you've asked the question, will our smartphones know us better than ourselves? So I wonder what your take is on technology, where our technology is headed, and are we getting too far ahead of ourselves, Ira?
Well, you know, there are very famous smart people who have said they are worried about artificial intelligence. I mean, people like Bill Gates, Elon Musk, people who are very smart, and they say you better watch out. If we don't think about it, we could be making robots that don't need us anymore. And then now you see all these movies that are coming out that popular science is following real science. And that sort of concerns me. I think it's concerned a little bit about where is the limit to how smart these objects can be. You know, I have a science fiction bent to me, and I see all these post-apocalyptic movies. I think, could this be true? I hope not.
You know? What do you think? IBM was announcing recently the Watson has expanded even more than what they had it before. I think it's in 100 universities and 20 other organizations at this point. What do you think of Watson?
Well, the idea behind Watson was not to make it a Jeopardy champ. That was just a demonstration. But it was to help make, I think, especially in medicine, is to help doctors diagnose diseases, because diagnosis is the hardest part of medicine, trying to figure out what's really wrong with you. And so if you have a machine that can, you know, be fed all the diagnostic tools and the algorithms to try to weed down what's wrong with you, it takes a lot of computing power. And I think that's, you know, where Watson is headed, at least in medical wise.
So it's a balancing act with technology. On the one hand, lots of good can come out of it, but you have to be careful.
Well, technology, you know, is not science. People confuse the two. Yeah. Science helps create technology. But we decide as people how to use or what technology to create and how to use it. And that's the direction. Science likes to do basic research where you don't really know where it's going to end up. We decide which part of that research we're going to take and make a technology out of it and how to make it.
Coming up, more with Ira Flatow, and Dean Regas will be joining us, and you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's Science Friday on a Monday for a change, and my guests this afternoon are the host of Science Friday, Ira Flatow, and Dean Regas, co-host of the PBS series Stargazers and assistant director at the Cincinnati Observatory. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dean, good to see you this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Dean, did you ever do anything as cool as making sparks with like lifesavers in a dark room? Did you ever do anything like that?
Well, I'm not sure if this story is completely acceptable for radio, but I did do this at a party way back when, a long time ago. This was right before Spin the Bottle. There was it was a good excuse to take your date into the closet, say, hey, check out this lifesaver. It really works. And then whatever happens after that, I don't know. I can't say anymore. But this is what the scientists
so cool. Well, that's what geek, you know, and it's cool to be a geek now.
Right.
And people will go for that.
That's right.
They used to say, oh, come on, you're just being a geek. Now it's cool.
Exactly. I was talking to Alan Alda was kind of talking about that, and you were talking about that too, is that we should have a name for the geeks. We're calling them Franklins, right? Isn't that your
Benjis.
Code word? Benjis. That's what it was.
Benjis. Flora Lichtman and I, our video producer, decided we would come up with the term Benji because Benjamin Franklin wasn't every person. He was a scientist, a statesman, a politician. He was into the arts. And now people are not just simple geeks anymore. They're multi-interested, you know? They're interested in all these things. Let's not call them geeks. Let's call them Benji. So something could be very Benji.
I like it. Geeky, I like it.
And science, as a result, is becoming more acceptable and more popular in this day and age.
Oh, definitely. And I see it with astronomy especially. I think that's probably the field of science that people, they want to know something about.
Is that the geekiest of the geekiest?
I'd say it's the coolest of the geeky.
Okay.
Because what's better than, what topic is bigger than the universe? I mean, there's nothing bigger than that. The discoveries that are being made right now, we're just in this golden age of discovering so many things. Every day there's something new. And so every week there's something new for science. Science Friday too.
Yeah, I think astronomy is the most popular subject whenever we talk about it, and there's always something great to talk about in astronomy. Yeah, you have your favorite horizon.
Sure. Yeah, you've got all sorts of things. You've got your favorite planet, your favorite spacecraft.
Right.
You've got the favorite comet. Now that we have the comet lander is back.
It's back online,
I cannot believe that.
That's the missing European Space Agency lander that they finally got a signal from.
Yeah, I like one of the writing. So it landed on this comet, bounced several times, and just rolled into this dark ditch where it couldn't see the sunlight. And so it was dead. They lost contact with it, and now it sent back some "Hello, I'm awake, I'm alive."
It actually tweeted.
It did tweet.
It tweeted.
It's very hip and current, then, isn't it?
That's right.
More proof that science is cool.
That's absolutely right.
I can't believe that thing is back sending messages, and so great to see because that mission is really cool.
It's amazing how popular that mission was. You know, it didn't take anybody to really – it was not really promoted heavily because it got into trouble and people started following it. That's all it took, you know, to let people know. The major media picked up because this is a spaceship in trouble and everybody followed along. You know?
Yeah, and the Rosetta mission that's still in orbit around that comet is sending back some amazing pictures. We're seeing the comet turn on now. It's starting to get jets on it, and it's a pretty amazing world.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation with Ira Flatow and Dean Regas. And you know, Dean, in fairness, I asked Ira what he was like when he was a kid. So I have to ask you, what were you like? Were you playing with chemistry sets, doing model rockets, that kind of stuff?
Well, science came to me later on in life, that's for sure. It only occurred to me later on that I could get girls that way. That was the only with the Lifesaver experiment, which probably I owed Ira for that. Thank you very much, Ira. But I was more into sports. As a kid, I was into any sport there was. You know, basketball, baseball, football, as a skateboarder, as a snowboarder, anything dangerous especially. Later on, I found that this was such a cool subject. I did so many other different things in my life, that a lot of travel, a lot of writing and teaching. And that's what really got me was being a teacher.
I have a way to make you an official geek. Huh? He's the official Science Friday pocket protector.
Oh, wow. That is so cool.
I haven't forgotten you.
Oh,
There you go.
I am so honored.
Official Science Friday Pocket Protector. You are now an official geek.
I'm putting it on right now. I need some pens to fill it with.
Well, there's a whole thing full of pens right in front of us.
At least one pen. There you go. Pen in there.
So take one of those. See, my problem has always been, Ira, that I stick pens and pencils in my pocket. I am a geek in that respect,
yes.
But I always mess my pockets.
There you
my
go. Never again.
She says they always have ink and pencil stains on them, so never again.
Never again.
I am honored. So let's talk with Dave in Covington. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon. I absolutely love the program.
Thank you.
I've been a database administrator for like 40 years, and that's essentially an IT geek. So I kind of qualify as a geek, pencil behind the ear and all that good stuff. But the thing that I have just lost or missed the absolute most is the ability that people used to have to work on things. When I was in high school, and this was a good number of years ago, but almost every guy in the school and most of the girls could lift the hood of a car and do something under there. You know, adjust a carburetor, change spark plugs, do something. That's almost impossible today. By the way, there's also a Radio Shack over in the Newport Shopping Center.
Dave.
I think it's the only one in Northern Kentucky, but there's still one left. And you used to be able to, you know, build kits and work on things. And have you ever tried to take your iPhone apart?
I sympathize with you. You know, I'm going to give you a project you can work on. There's something called an Arduino chip. It's like the hottest Arduino. It is the new chip of modern geekdom. And I just bought a set. I just bought a whole kit that you can make little projects with this chip. It's already built into a breadboard. It comes with little parts and resistors and stuff. You stick it all together and it will control something. You can make it control something from your cell phone or something else like that. If you want to get back into the kit building stuff, this is the hottest way to do that, because I sympathize with you. You know, I used to fix black and white TVs, and then color came in and I was done because it was got too difficult. And cars. You're absolutely right.
Well,
do you work on cars?
I mean, yeah, I used to work on cars, and now I have a hybrid. I think it was Click and Clack. They said that the new cars are the death of man, because now we can't fix anything.
You just the computer inside the car.
There is such great, you feel so good when you could open up the hood of the car and actually do something.
We're not as hands-on as we used to be.
I know.
In some respects.
Yep.
And in some ways, we're more hands-on than we used to be, though, with technology.
We can be pretty savvy with a lot of things, especially with communication. I think that's where we've really made big strides in communicating.
Well, now you can learn how to make an app. Instead of fixing something, you can make an app and do something that way that controls something else.
Yeah, we're just hands-on in different ways.
Yes.
Let's talk with Bill in Madisonville. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I have a question about the self-driving car technology, like the Google car. And I'm curious about your guess. You know, how quickly do you see that emerging to the point where it begins to influence, you know, the number of lanes, reducing demand for parking, reducing spending on roads and bridges? How do you see that rolling out in 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
Okay. Thank you, Bill.
You want to take it, Dean?
Oh, that's all yours.
I'm just thinking, we don't know how soon self-driving cars will be in the mainstream. It's going to be, as you say, 5 or 10 years. We have to be able to get the cars to all talk to one another first, so that you're in an intersection and your car knows there's another car waiting to turn left there. We haven't gotten to that point yet, I don't think.
Yeah,
so they have to talk to each other.
I think there are a lot of political and legal obstacles still.
Yeah.
That even if the science is there, that you still have to get past those things.
Yeah. It will all be done because there'll be someone who's making money on this. And, you know, and I think the money is, if you're not driving your car, you'll be on the internet buying stuff. So there'll be 24 hours a day. You don't have to do anything but be on the internet.
Wow. That's right. So yeah, you can, instead of listening to the radio, you can surfing. You can do everything.
But yeah, I'm not so sure. You know, I still like to drive my car.
Well, right. So how are these
That's the other thing you have to get past.
Self-driven cars, how are they going to react to the old-fashioned driven by IRA cars, you know?
Well, that's a good question. What if you don't want to give up your 10-year-old car and it's not equipped, you know, and it's not retrofitted? These are all interesting and good questions things take a generation. I've always learned that things take 20 to 30 years to change.
Yeah, and all these things have to be thought out before the driverless car will become commonly accepted, I think. So
yeah,
it's going
to
take some time.
Take the bus instead until then.
Dean, how are things going with Stargazers?
Stargazers is going great. I've been over there with the PBS show. It's been almost 5 years now we've been on the air, taking over for the late Jack Horkheimer. And so we're on locally here. We're on Channel 48 and Channel 14 pretty much every single day. You can also watch the shows online, too. There's a stargazersonline.org is a website, or you can watch at the Cincinnati Observatory website, too. We have all the videos there. We can even tell you what's coming in the future in June and July. I think we've already just posted the July shows, so people can see that. The big news right now is in a few weeks, we're having a planetary conjunction. Venus and Jupiter are coming closer together than they have in a long, long time. Wow. These are the two brightest planets in the sky. You've probably been seeing them every night after the sun goes down. And watch them over the next 2 weeks. They're going to inch closer day by day. And on June 30th, that's the magic day. That's when they're going to be right next to each other.
It's not a Friday, is it?
It is a Tuesday. I wish it was. I wish it was. I'd be happy to talk about the Friday before.
Okay. And we are all geeking out about this right now.
This is going to be good. I mean, because people have been noticing these planets at night, and we get a lot of UFO calls also at this time of year when we see these bright planets. But I can't wait to, as they get closer, kind of the excitement builds, and then the 30th will be the big day.
Now, we've also got a flyby of Pluto. That's coming up later this summer, don't we?
Oh, this is huge.
Gonna be great.
This is something we've been waiting for our whole lives, that we're finally going to get a close up picture of Pluto. This is a planet almost 4 billion miles away from us, and to get something there, it takes a lot. So this spacecraft called New Horizons left Earth 9.5 years ago, and it'll get there July 14th. It's going to fly by Pluto, take pictures of it, its five moons. And we're finally going to get to see what Pluto looks like. This is one of those unexplored territories that as kids we always dreamed of what Pluto would be like.
Here we have something that's not a planet but still has five moons.
Exactly.
It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, this is shaping up to be the year of the dwarf planets, isn't it?
Exactly. We had a spacecraft in orbit around Ceres that's right now. It's called the Dawn mission, which is sending back some very mysterious pictures of that asteroid.
People wearing Science Friday pocket holders on the planet or things like that.
There's a mysterious bright spot on it that nobody's been able to explain what it is yet. And they keep flying by, taking pictures. And so
it says sci-fi.
It must say, I don't know. Well, somebody said the monolith. It's the monolith. That's what's, and I was like,
do you hear any music when you're
there? That's right. But we've got that going on. And then Pluto, I think that's going to be a big hit. And we're going to be open at the observatory that night, the 14th of July. That's when the first data is going to be coming back. So about 9:02, that's when we're supposed to get our first signal back from the New Horizons spacecraft, where everybody in NASA's headquarters cheers and, we did it, all that kind of stuff. So we're going to be there waiting for that, too. Mm.
513-419-7100 to join us. And let's speak with Bob in Batavia. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
Hey, I was calling to see if anyone felt a little disappointed like I do. When I was 13 in 1960, used to see science fiction, and then the Jetsons came along, and there were flying cars, and I thought by the year 2000 we'd have flying cars and a lot of the things that are in science fiction, and it seems like we slowed down somewhere. We went to the moon and 69, and then we kind of lost some steam. Anybody have that feeling, or has it been converted into other fields?
Well, I'll jump in. I think we lost an idea of the big project. We don't have big projects. You know, the race to the moon was 10 years, went through, you know, three different presidents. How many things now could go 10 years and go through three different presidents? Very hard to keep big money going. That takes big money to do these things. When you think about today, we have drones instead of cars. We have so many drones. Imagine every one of those drones was a car. What kind of calamity we might have up there. Because whenever you see the Jetsons or any of these movies, there are only three cars in the air, right? There are three cars flying around. Imagine if there are 3,300 cars flying around at the same time.
Yeah, there's certain things about that logistics of traffic jams in space. I think you're right. There's certain elements that science fiction kind of promised us in some ways, you know, these that we'd be farther along in space travel also. That's one thing that we see Star Trek and we think – now, of course, we got to think Star Trek is how many years from now? Is 400 years in the future? Isn't it – so we got a long way to go. But there's other ways that we can think of it too, is that right now we are – in the solar system. Humans are not traveling to Mars yet, but we have that spacecraft I think it's almost done around Mercury. We had one around Venus. We have three around Mars, one around Saturn, one on its way to Jupiter, one at an asteroid, one going to Pluto. I mean, I would have
still
never...
have the rovers on Mars.
And we got two rovers on Mars too. I mean, we are out there. Our surrogates are out there, and whether that we're not physically traveling, we're getting some amazing stuff. And back to the Pluto mission, is that was the greatest moment when that rocket left Earth, because they were debating that for so long. And once that rocket leaves Earth and goes to Pluto, it's beyond the human concerns. It's the petty political things. It's off, and there's no turning back.
Nothing ever turns out like you think it's going to turn out.
Well, right. Our wise producer, Pete Reitmeier, points out that Back to the Future 2, October the 1st of this year is the date we were supposed to have hoverboards.
My flux capacitor is
high. I don't see hoverboards on the horizon.
There are no hoverboards. That's right. That is disappointing.
Yeah.
But think of all the other things that we have that we would have that weren't in science fiction that we still use on a daily basis. And it's technology and science.
Not to mention medicine. I mean, there's so much medicine. There's so many advances in medicine that we never thought about. We were fixated with space. But there are all kinds of disease cures and advances in medicine now, and genetic engineering creating all kinds of things that we never anticipated.
So. You're talking about science fiction. This is an anniversary for Jules Verne, isn't it?
That's true. Yes, yeah. This is the 150th anniversary of Jules Verne's momentous science fiction novel, From the Earth to the Moon. And this is the one. Jules Verne to me is such a great writer to read. Even today, his language is a little stilted, but there's so many subtle little jokes in there. I love the little jokes, and it's a great journey to show how they thought we would go to the moon in the past, and how close it actually is to how we did go to the moon. There's a lot of similarities. So I highly recommend picking that up. It was published 1865, over 100 years before the Apollo astronauts went to the moon. And so they launch off from Florida, they circle around the moon, and they land in the Pacific Ocean in an aluminum craft with three astronauts.
Pretty good.
Pretty amazing.
From America, and picked up by an American vessel in the Pacific Ocean.
Mm. And Tang was mentioned in there too.
And I'm sure Tang was there.
Did Jules Verne's have an influence on you?
I was not influenced by Jules Verne, but I did. Isaac Asimov used to write stuff about Mars and those books, you know. Really, were stuff that I got interested in. But I was always a believer that fact is stranger than fiction. Stuff that was going on all the time, you know, fiction has trouble catching up even to that stuff. You start to see some of the things that have been discovered and that you would never think existed on the planet. It's just, I don't need the fiction that much, although there's some great fiction. Talk about Mars. There's a book called The Martian. You've read The Martian?
Mm-hmm. I have.
It's now a major motion picture coming out.
It's a very interesting book about how to survive. I mean, this guy has this will to survive on this inhospitable planet. And that's what Mars is. And I liked it a lot because it's a sobering reality of when we send people to Mars, mm-hmm. There's a lot to think about before we go. And that's why we haven't done it yet. But hopefully soon.
Yeah.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's speak with Alice in Anderson. Hi, Alice.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question for Ira. I have a daughter who's very much interested in preparing for a science communication field, and I was wondering if Ira might have some advice as to courses she should take, graduate school she should attend, or professional work she should do.
Is she interested in any one science in particular?
She's a physics major in addition to a creative writing major, minoring in astronomy.
That's great. That's great. I would tell her to get her degree in physics, because that's the harder thing to do. Anybody can be a writer. You know, you just write. And you can practice that and get better at it. It's harder to become a physicist on your own. And then you can specialize. So I would say stay with your coursework in physics. Get a blog going. You don't need to have a newspaper or anything going. Get a blog going on your own. Get a podcast going on your own. And you'll get discovered that way. And then people will hear what you'll have a portfolio of things that you do. And you'll develop your own style. A school, there are journalism schools around there. And I know I've been to most of them. You know, journalism school is 9 months of training. I mean, I never went to J school. I learned on the job. But if you want to, so that's why I say go with the harder stuff first and specialize.
Alice, thank you for the call. How important, Ira, is science in the whole educational process for kids?
How important is science?
Yeah, where do you put that on your pyramid?
Well, you know what? I think that science needs to be taught a little bit differently in school. Kids are all born natural scientists. When we were kids, you wanted to take the Pop-Tart and stick it in the VCR, right? Because it looked like it fit. I want to do that experiment. Because I'm a kid and it looks like it should work. But what happens? You get your hands slapped for doing that kind of thing instead of being directed the right way. Second, we don't teach science. We teach how to be a scientist. When you go to physics class or chemistry class, we teach you chemistry. We teach you physics. But if you go to music class, you may learn how to play the trombone or something, but they teach you music appreciation. They teach you art appreciation. We don't teach kids how to appreciate science. We don't teach them what science does for them. We don't tell them who the great scientists are, like you might say, who the great painters or musicians are. We need to teach, I think, how to appreciate and understand what science does for you so you can know what good science is and what junk science is.
So who's your great scientist? Who would you put at the top of your list?
Who's still alive today?
Anybody.
I would go with Eric Kandel, Columbia University. If you want to talk about popular scientists, there are all kinds of popular scientists around. There are all kinds of physicists. Everybody talks about Einstein all the time. He's still a popular figure. He had all kinds of things to say that people don't quote him anymore. And the other things that were outside of science, like my favorite Einstein quote, besides, well, there are a lot of them, is those who have the privilege to know have the duty to tell.
Mm-hmm.
If you know something, and that's what I think about what Science Friday does. We have the privilege to know. We have the duty to tell you about it. And so, Richard Feynman is a great popularizer of science.
Most definitely, most definitely.
Who are some of the people on your list, Dean?
Well, top on my list is Galileo. I mean, he's just for a historical figure, he's a guy straddling two worlds from superstition to science. He was kind of the first guy to try to figure out what it was like to be a scientist. And I'd like to think of that as kids. They're trying to figure that out as well, too, with their information. And I like the idea of teaching science a little bit differently. We've really noticed the power of the field trip. And that's something we want to really bring back, is that schools cut field trips. And this is the places where a lot of scientists got their inspiration.
That's a hands-on experience.
Hands-on. Yeah. And so we would love schools and teachers to really take advantage of visiting their science centers and observatories and planetariums, because I think that's where a lot of people get inspired.
Let's talk with Chloe. Hi, Chloe. Hello, Chloe. Okay, so we've lost connection. She had a question that concerned Jurassic Park, which brings up the question. It's not if we can do something, but if we should do something. I guess it's the old saying, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Well, I mean, I just saw Jurassic World last night, actually, the new one last night. It's got an interesting ending.
Don't do that.
No spoiler. No, I won't do that. But Jurassic Park, should we create these sort of, you know, people talk about this still now. Should we create the, you know, it's possible to recreate a mastodon. Could you do that? You can come very close to it using an elephant as a model. I think we should take it as far as maybe not the last step and then decide whether we should do it or not. But we should do the basic research that would get us there. It's very much like genetic engineering when it was invented in 1974. The tools to splice genes was invented, and they stopped doing what they were doing to talk about it and say, is this something that we should do?
Yeah,
because what are the benefits of it? I don't think there's a realistic fear that the mastodon and they're going to start taking over the world or anything like that. But yeah, what are the benefits to doing it? Is there some scientific value in it? And I think the answer is yes. For those that are working through this, but just to do science for the sake of science, that is a very interesting question that people have been posing for all these years.
Hey, what's the real quick? What's the next big astronomical event that's coming up
Well, let's see. Right now it's Saturn season. So I was talking about Venus and Jupiter getting close together, but Saturn is the main object for people to look at with their backyard telescopes. Look up their pier. You look to the south-southeast, it looks like an ordinary yellow star. But then when you put your eye up to that telescope and you see it up close, you see the rings, you see some moons. It's just like it's surreal. It's the most perfect object to see in a telescope. So,
do we have a meteor shower?
We do have the Perseid meteor showers always in August. So right around August 12th, which is great for the summertime. You get out there. It's not quite as cold as in the winter ones. And so that one should be a good one, too.
Yeah.
Ira and Dean, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
My pleasure.
Science Friday host Ira Flatow, who's in Cincinnati for a WVXU member event tonight, and Dean Regas, co-host of Stargazers and assistant director with the Cincinnati Observatory. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier with help from Kevin Reynolds. The technical director was Rick Andres. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7 WVXU.